Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. This week has seen a conference take place about the future of conservatism, billed as an opportunity to explore the best path forward for a democratic world confronted by a rising China abroad and a powerful new Marxism at home. The National Conservatism Conference perhaps gained even more traction than it might otherwise have had, coming at a time when it is generally agreed that a muffled starting gun has been fired for the next general election, expected to take place in the autumn of 2024. So to help me take stock of where we are politically and the possible psychological impact of this churn of ideas coming through, I'm delighted to welcome to my couch one of the speakers at the conference, Ed West, a man passionate about history and whose Substack blog is called The Wrong Side of History. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
Great to have you on my couch, as they say. Before I ask you about where we are now in this sort of phony war of a general election that we still assume is about a year away from being called, I want my listeners to get a sense of you so that not least they can seek you out and seek out more of your writing. And I want to go to something that you were writing about very recently, this worry that you have that there is currently a political drift, if you like, to a form of soft totalitarianism where there's a lot of activism almost being inserted into every aspect of our lives. Could you say a little bit more about what you meant by that and maybe why it's happening now? You know, what is the psychological climate that's breeding this?
Sure. I mean, my overarching theme or theory about the world is that I do follow the political religions and belief that when religion starts to decline, politics becomes a replacement, a moral lodestar. And I think modern progressivism, I mean, in the States, it has definitely tracked the decline in church going. And as a younger generation seek a sort of spiritual answers and a kind of all guiding worldview and truth. And I think that's one reason why, you know, the progressive left has been quite effective, because it does offer a kind of whole world moral idea, which the sort of conservatism doesn't, in the sense that the right-wing politics tend to be a sort of absence of any overriding philosophy. They tend to be a sort of collection of people who disagree with this overriding sort of left-wing worldview. And we don't really have the same kind of moral worldview to teach kids. So there's, you know, I mean, I think the thing that, you know, teenagers tend to believe now, you know, the kind of classic things that that gets called woke, although I hate that phrase, it is a kind of enticing worldview. I happen to think it's wrong. I mean, I think it's wrong for a number of reasons, not to do, at least to do biology, but people do naturally seek out a sort of moral worldview. And when something's someone's religion, it's very hard to disentangle it from everyday life. You cannot have a private religion, almost by definition. And so I find increasingly in every kind of sphere of civil society, even down to sort of things like street WhatsApp groups, people feel it much more appropriate to sort of make political statements and get politics involved in areas where traditionally you weren't really, people did not mention politics because it was just agreed that it would just cause disagreements with people. And people accepted that there are people who disagree with them, which I think there is less of now. There is a real feeling that you know, you are basically really like evil, and you know, and you see that this week, obviously, the people at this conference have been called all sorts of things, you know, fascist and various other things, which is I think a very common belief amongst both the centre left and the hard left.
But when you're talking about these WhatsApp groups, the community WhatsApp groups that have become more political, and a broader observation around this hole in people's lives where religion might reasonably once have thought to reside, what you seem to be talking about is a sort of craving for connection and a craving for the answers that can also come from connection that we see so exquisitely in our early tribe, which is our family. You know, you don't know how to do things, so you look to the elders, who are your parents, to find out how to hold a knife and fork, how to tie your shoelaces, why is grass green, why doesn't, you know, little Sally like me in the playground any longer. We are always looking for answers, and then we used to find those answers for broader things in religion, but now we're looking at them in politics. But why, therefore, is the Conservative Party not prepared to have that moral argument to provide those answers?
Well, there's been a, in the last 70 years, there's been a, you know, a huge moral revolution in the West. And, you know, I think it's comparable with the Reformation and the Christianization of Rome. And things which were, you know, it's been described as a moral inversion or repaganization. Lots of things which were once considered bad and now good, and vice versa, and none more so than sexual matters and matters to do with the individual. And the Conservative Party is kind of, you know, there are old believers amongst the Conservative Party. You know, we heard them with Danny Kruger the other day, who are sort of literally old believers. They're Christians and they believe in a sort of Christian morality, but society is, that's very much, you know, that's, this reformation has happened and those kind of beliefs are on the back foot. That there isn't an electoral force for a party that actually stood up for those kind of things, that actually said, we want, you know, we do want the kind of morality of before 1968 to sort of make a comeback. It just wouldn't be electorally realistic. So, you know, conservatism or the right, whatever you call it, is a coalition of different groups, and it's traditionally a coalition of conservatives and liberals, and it tends to work because it was in alliance against socialism, and that was the big thing that held the Conservative Party together. So it had all sorts of different beliefs, but they all wanted to stop, you know, the overwhelming power of the state. But you know, the politics has now realigned that the Conservatives and Liberals aren't really natural bedfellows anymore. Mm-hmm. So there is a slight incoherence in the right. And I think that's very apparent in the Conservative Party in the last 13 years. You know, we have this thing now of Tory ministers, you know, saying about, who are basically criticising the government, who have said, you know, criticising the record of the government. And it's almost like, you know, you've had 13 years. you're in power. You could literally do something about this. But it's such a sort of unstable alliance. And it's quite clear that most of the MPs are, you know, far more socially liberal than the people that they represent. You know, the average Tory MP is about as socially liberal as the average Labour voter now.
Yeah.
So there's a complete mismatch between the voters and the party. And I think one of the basic facts of politics is that, you know, you need, with these lines, a kind of strong glue to hold everything together. And probably the strongest glue and the most powerful force, or the, you know, the ace in the pack for the right, is probably something to do with nationalism of some sort of national identity, especially since the big dividing line in politics now is not about the distribution of resources as it was in the 20th century between left and right. It's now between global influence and local influence. Now, personally, I mean, I'm, you know, torn by this, because I wouldn't consider myself a nationalist, because I think coming from England, it just seems like a very alien idea. England's been independent, and I know people will get annoyed, confused with England and Britain, but the British state was an extension of the English state in many ways. We've never experienced any kind of need for nationalism. It just seems strange. But,
well, that's our island. You know, we have the psychology.
The island, yes, we've got
the island mentality.
I mean, exactly. We've got, as Shakespeare has John of Gaunt saying, you know, we've got this, we're protected, civil jewel, this jewel. And although with the number of small boats coming, you wouldn't actually think so. But now the forces of globalization do feel like they are running out of control, in the sense that they work against the strength of democracy. And democracy and globalization are really in a bit of conflict. And so inevitably, you know, the two poles of politics are going to be basically a pro-global party and a sort of national Democrat kind of party. And I mean Democrats in the sense that they represent an idea of a people, you know, a separate people themselves. So, I mean, in that sense, I think the national is probably going to be the sort of the future of the right in many ways. It will be the thing that holds all these kind of, because in these things like this, in this conference, you know, there are lots of people with very, very different views on lots of subjects. And some will be much more, you know, conservative than others on, you know, on social issues to do with morality. Also, you have religious people, you have very atheist people. I mean, that is what the coalitions are. But they all seem to have a sense that the national identity is quite important.
And yet, as you highlight, it's incredibly conflicted. And maybe what you would like to believe is that the Conservative Party can hold those conflicts in some kind of exquisite tension, but there's no guarantee that that will actually happen, that actually it could spin off. I'm nervous about using the psychological diagnosis of schizophrenia, because schizophrenia is a very misunderstood condition.
It feels
very very split, let's put it that way, that there is a psychological split. And you alluded to Danny Kruger's speech around marriage in particular, which is basically saying marriage is a fantastic institution and we should encourage more and more people to stay married for the sake of the children, which certently from my clinical experience flies in the face of all the work that's been done over the last 50 years to, you know, reduce the stigma around people saying this relationship is toxic or unhealthy and I need to get out for my mental health and also for the mental health of my kids. And it's a really good, you know, I'm role modeling for my children that you shouldn't put up with a bad relationship. How do you have people who think those two completely contrasting views within the same party?
Well, I mean, those are conflicts. I mean, all of these things are conflicts between, you know, the desire for the human individual needs to seek happiness and safety, and the society's needs for sort of strict norms that hold it together. And all sexual matters post 1968 or whatever are a clash of those things. Obviously, it's healthier for a society where most people are married and stay married and have kids. It's for the individual, it might be absolutely tragic. It might be all these things. Voting, like politics is just about forming coalitions, ultimately. And when you find a correlation between beliefs in certain things, so, you know, you have a correlation between people who have a strong sense of national identity will tend to have more conservative views on things like marriage and sexuality, those kind of things. So it makes more sense that they align on those. So even if you will find, if you find a group of 100 people who care about the national identity, more of them will be more towards Danny Kruger than if people. So that's, from that sense, it's just basically bundling people together, right? The most important thing to win elections or to direct the course of your country is to have an overriding, you know, there's the core idea, which is what matters. And that's what keeps the coalition together. You know, so Margaret Thatcher, you know, whatever you think of her, she was very effective, what she did. And, you know, her core idea was about the economy and giving freedom to individuals and sort of, you know, reducing the power of the unions. And all the other contradictions, you know, I mean, Thatcher wasn't really socially conservative. She was personally, you know, a sort of Gladstonian Victorian liberal, but her policies weren't socially conservative. But the coalition was able to stay together because they had that one overriding view. And if there's anything that's going to keep any kind of right-wing coalition afloat in the future, the national identity is going to be the strongest one. It's also the one issue where a lot of small C conservative voters in Britain and the US, they aren't particularly like morally conservative in the old fashioned sense. Like, you know, Trump voters have very heavy divorce rates, very heavy rates of marriage, children outside marriage. Actually, a lot of newer conservative voters tend to be very liberal on things like homosexuality. They're not sort of old fashioned social conservatives, as in like churchgoers, but they do tend to have strong feelings towards their country. And they do have quite a lot of opposition to the very high levels of immigration we've had, and they do tend to not like the kind of masochistic elements of modern progressivism in terms of race and gender, which is you know, these are all sort of obviously cultural wars, and I haven't, you know, stopped talking about the material needs, which are obviously very important as well. But you know, the kind of that kind of cultural conservative belief in your own country and having pride in it is probably the sort of, I don't know the phrase, it's the overwhelming kind of glue that holds the coalition together.
The irony is, listening to you speak and using certain terms like cultural conservatism or whatever it might be, is that actually the beginning of the speech that you gave was a cri de coeur, I felt, for us to get away from labels. You told the story about being away in France, I think it was. You were with your wife's
South
family.
France, yeah.
All the in-laws are discussing this much-loved grandmother. And as often happens, particularly at funerals, you or at weddings or whatever it might be, these sort of social hub events that bring families together, people talk about their relationships. They talk about their memories of that person and the things they did with that person, rather than the labels. And you say very few people will talk about your job unless you're a Nobel Prize winner. So I guess no one's ever going to talk about my job at my funeral. But where are we going wrong then?
I'm sure they probably will.
Sorry?
I just wanted to sort of, my basic point was that, yes, these relationships matter, and that's what's you're going to, you know, I think that the thing, identity, is that most of our identities have become a lot weaker over time, because they tended to be related to our town or particularly certain types of jobs. People had a very strong sense of who they were in those things. But, you know, identity politics is sort of, it's a kind of, it's a convenient phrase to basically describe the electoral coalitions that have arisen since the 1960s, you know, with the left took on a coalition of basically minorities, ethnic minorities, sexual minorities, and working women, and that became the coalition, the Rainbow Coalition, and that's what people usually talk about identity politics. People with very strong, those three strong identities. But I think generally, you know, older identities have tended to kind of weaken as we've become. You know, like our local identity is much weaker than it once was, for example. But, you know, it's a different thing. So it's a difference between, there are certain, you know, if you want to talk about philosophically about what is best in life and about what about the best way to live your life, that is very different to, you know, how we actually win in politics. So I suppose my point about that was that in the long term, none of that really matters. I mean, what's more important is that people remember us. But, you know, in the hard stuff of like politics, you have to actually slightly label people and categorize people. And, you know, the difference between, you know, social conservatives and cultural conservatives is, I would say, social conservatives. And the irony is that the real social conservatives aren't like the red wall people. Social conservatives, you know, the wealthy are still more likely to go to church, even in Britain and in America. The wealthy are much more likely to get married, far less likely to get divorced. All these kind of personally conservative lifestyles are much more found amongst the educated, who might even identify as being very progressive. While, you know, the conservative movement tends to cater for an electorate which has, you know, things like higher rates of divorce, etc. So that's kind of a paradox. I mean, you know, we're all sorts of living double lives in this, in a way.
We're all living double lives, and the way in which we navigate the world when there is so much of that flux is to always try to revert to a sense of safety. And I was very struck by one of the other issues in your talk, which was about housing, because for most people, that is the one thing that makes them feel safe, you know, that they've got a secure, that they've got a peaceful base to go back to, which is why there's been so much trauma, I think, for a particular generation. And you said you had, well, I thought the most arresting stat of your talk was that we have more homeless people than primary school children, and we have more dogs than children.
So that was in San Francisco, which is the way we're heading. But yeah, there are another secondary school announced its closure in South London last week, and it's just simply not affordable to live. And to me, that's the overwhelming issue that needs to be addressed more than anything else, really. So, you know, I find it frustrating even when I see videos or speeches about politicians talking about gender identity, when, you know, like the housing thing is so much more important. You know, material needs really do matter. And this has got to, you know, quite a crisis point. And I don't think it's really understood by enough people.
Okay. And what do you think the long term is that going to be on that? You suggested that we're going to destroy the quality of life for a whole generation because of this.
I think we have already,
given, you know, the mental health crisis as a result of younger people working from home in a studio flat with 16 other people. I mean, it's not sustainable. What do you think the long term impact of that is going to be on people, and are we ever going to really address it politically?
It's very extremely hard to address because Tory voters tend to own their homes, and people hate new homes being built, and it's universally, and Tories have even lost seats at local elections to the Greens, because the Greens are even more pro-NIMBY, but they dress it up in environmentalism. It's a tragedy to commons in that it's no one's interest to have housing built near them. But if everyone stopped housing, then it's disastrous. And there are lots of cities and towns in southern England which have been basically artificially restricted from growing, which their residents love. And lots of people think, oh, Oxford and Cambridge, you know, I want them to keep their character. That they naturally, if they were allowed to grow, Oxford and Cambridge would both be close to about a million people. They are natural centres of the economy in Britain. And they've been completely restricted. And then this is also tied up to the issue of immigration, which is now running at incredibly high levels, which I think is the really, really bitter issue at the heart of the Tory party, the real sense of betrayal, really, because you talked earlier about the contradictions and the kind of the mind splitting almost within the Tory party. But, you know, all parties remain contradictions until the contradiction becomes too unbearable and they split, often quite bitterly. And Brexit, I think, accelerated that a little sense in that there were two very different senses of what Brexit was supposed to be. And there was the free trader, you know, old-fashioned right liberal worldview, which was a global Britain. And that was very much the minority opinion amongst Brexit voters. But it was the majority opinion amongst Conservative MPs who got through Brexit. And then there was the sort of more, I suppose, anti-globalization or slowing down globalization, the kind of Little Englander version of Brexit, which specifically wanted lower immigration. They wanted higher wages, and they wanted the brakes on immigration. And the Tory party won because of them. They had the numbers. And then they've done the opposite, and they've massively increased immigration. I think there's a real bitterness about that. And it feels like there's a bitterness. I know I am almost by definition in an echo chamber right now, because I'm in a conference of people who agree with me, but the Tories are on mid-20% in the polls, and I think they will struggle to they will struggle to get much higher, because I think a lot of people would just think, I'm not going to vote for them again because of what they did. So that's a sort of social issue that also compounds that great economic issue, which also compounds with the aging society thing. You know, it's as society ages, it's becoming harder to fill in certain positions. There just aren't enough people around. And as society ages, we're going to get sort of poorer. I mean, I don't think on the children front, you know, I'm not, you know, I strongly believe people, obviously in a good society, people will aim to have their optimum number of children. And I don't think people should feel worthless for not having. That's why, I mentioned, Shakespeare and Elizabeth I don't have surviving descendants, but we don't think that they're not part of our, they're not, we're not their posterity. It doesn't make their contribution possible. But I do think a lot of people are really, really would like to have families and are completely denied this chance. And the high cost of housing. I mean, there are just so many people going into their 30s who are just living in these really overcrowded shared places in really unpleasant parts of London. And a generation ago, you know, they would have easily been able to afford a decent house by this stage. Two generations ago, you know, it would have been incredible. And just seeing that quality of life go down and down and down for generation. And there are all sorts of huge global forces causing this to the economy that we can't, you know, that's little, you know, basically there's more demand for housing in the most in a few sort of economic hubs. Everyone wants to move there. So it's going to be more expensive, whatever happens. But it's just very tragic that this happened to a generation. You know, I've got children that were, who are teens and below teens, and I mean, I really don't know that how they're gonna, you know, navigate the life in London if that's where they want to live when they're older. And then the unfortunate thing is that this housing thing is also a problem in every other English speaking country as well. It's a particular English speaking phenomenon. So it's not like, you know, with a heavy heart, I could say, well, you know, we go to Australia and find a life, but they've got the same problem now.
Exactly. So at least the conference was having these conversations, which are difficult, which are complicated, and even if answers aren't forthcoming, at least there is some intellectual debate around.
Yeah, I always think it's good to get these things out in the open, to at least talk about them. I mean, because you definitely can't solve them if they're not brought up.
Whether they will be solved before the general election or not is yet to be seen. But for now, Ed West, thank you very much indeed for being my guest on the couch.
Bye-bye.